Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have been impressed for a long time by a man who has been studying and analyzing and informing the rest of us about one of the most insidious aspects of that war, the home front. And in particular, when those of us who have had the privilege to serve in the government or military of the United States taken an oath to protect our country, our Constitution, against all enemies, foreign and domestic, there are few people who have understood or certainly done more to help expose enemies domestic than our guest Trevor Loudon. Trevor is the author of important books and the director and driving force behind an important movie about the extent to which our government has been penetrated by such enemies, entitled The Enemy Within. I always look forward to the chance to visit with him, but I'm particularly pleased to be able to do so here at the Conservative Political Action Conference, in a segment we have pre-taped as that conference was going on and playing for you right now. But Trevor is with me in the flesh. It's always good to have him in any form, but particularly to do so in person. Welcome back, Trevor Loudon.
Hey, look, it's great to be on, Frank, and it's a real pleasure to catch up with you.
Well, the pleasure is mine, needless to say, but I want to make sure that the audience is pleased by learning some of the things that I have learned from you over the years. And you have a marvelous expression that kind of captures the problem in a distilled way. Would you share with us key insight there?
I say there are at least 100 members of your House of Representatives and 20 members of your U.S. Senate who are so enmeshed in Muslim Brotherhood front groups or neo-Marxist groups, or in some cases both, they wouldn't be able to pass an FBI background check to drive a school bus.
Wow.
They wouldn't be allowed to sell you stamps at the post office or to serve or to clean the toilets at a U.S. military base. But they're serving on the Intelligence Committee, the Homeland Security Committee, the Armed Services Committee, and they are trashing the Constitution every single day.
Yeah, and your comment there explains that this isn't just because they're incompetent, but that this is a purposeful assault on our Constitution. Is that right?
Look, for a long time you had two political parties in this country, the Republicans and the Democrats. And you had liberal Republicans and you had conservative Democrats. You know, it was pretty hard to tell sometimes which party a person belonged to. But the left started to really infiltrate the Democratic Party in the 1960s, mainly through the labor unions. Mm. But that went into overdrive in 1994. Because that was when Democrats...
Before we go to 94, though, let's talk about the takeover of the labor unions, because that's a story that I think most of us don't know.
Well, see, the labor unions in America were quite unusual because they were run by anti-communists like Lane Kirkland and George Meany.
Right.
But in the late 80s and early 90s, Democratic Socialists of America took over AFSCME, the Government Workers Union. They took over SEIU, and they used that union muscle to depose Lane Kirkland in 1994 and place their member, a Marxist, John Sweeney, into the AFL-CIO presidency in 1994. Mm. Now, the first thing he did was to remove the bar in the AFL-CIO's constitution banning communists from holding office. And he removed that restriction. The Marxists came flooding back in, They took over every major labour union in the country, and now the unions are completely in the tank for the hard left.
Yeah. You know, I remember
to influence the Democratic Party,
and not only influence it, but really to
to take it over.
You know, I'm reminded that my old boss Ronald Reagan, of course, became a profound anti-communist because of his exposure to the communists in the Screen Actors Guild
in
the Hollywood unions.
That is how he learned how communists work.
Right, and profoundly affected him, and he actually testified against those communists. And he served with incalculably important effect as an antidote during his time to a lot of that communist agenda, the Marxists and so on. In 94, they took over the labor unions. At what point do you suggest they really began so dramatically transforming the Democratic Party as to make it the unrecognizable engine of the radical left and, for that matter, the Sharia supremacist agenda that it is today?
Yeah, well, look, they went into overdrive from that point, and they started purging the conservative senators and the moderate senators. Joe Lieberman was the last conservative Democrat to go, or moderate Democrat to go. He was far too pro-Israel for their liking.
Right.
So they
forced to run as an independent.
They forced to run as an independent. Yeah. So they used that. See, if you control labor unions, you effectively control who gets elected and who gets selected for Democrat office. Mm. And that applies right from county commission up to federal and presidential level.
Right. What I'm concerned about, though, Trevor Loudon, is that in addition to this tragic takeover of a party I actually was a member of back in the day, morphing it into really the political operational arm of the red-green axis, as it's been called, the red left, the green Islamists, you now have this, as you say, coming together in the person of Keith Ellison, the Democratic member of Congress from Minnesota, who is now both the chairman of the Progressive Caucus, which is, of course, the radical left in Congress, plus the number two man in the Democratic National Committee. And these forces are now joined at the hip in his person, but also more generally, as you know, Trevor Loudon, and are a force that may shape dramatically what the Democrats hope will be a wave election. The people here at the Conservative Political Action Conference, I think, are concerned about that and determined to try to do what they can to prevent it. But tell us what's at stake if they should succeed.
Well, what's at stake? See, you're right about Keith Ellison. He is a lifelong associate of the Communist Party USA, of Maoist groups in Minnesota, but also the Nation of Islam, and several Muslim Brotherhood front groups. He is the enemy's enemy. He's the epitome, the archetype of this whole movement. And he's really at the rudder now. So what you're seeing is you're seeing the left of the Democratic Party basically aligning with the hard left of the Democratic Party. All the moderates are being squeezed out. All the conservatives are being squeezed out. So you have this very, very militant faction. What they're doing right now is pouring huge amounts of money and resources and thousands of organizers into Texas, Florida, Arizona, Georgia, and North Carolina. And they are working
swing states.
The swing states, they're working the old rainbow coalition strategy of Jesse Jackson. They're trying to unite the progressive whites, progressive Latinos, progressive blacks, Asian Americans, Muslim Americans, Native Americans, and gay Americans into a revamp of Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition. And they figure that is 51% of the electorate. And they are planning to basically destroy the Trump presidency as much as they can, then run the Rainbow Coalition strategy in 2018 and 2020.
We have to leave it at that. Trevor Loudon, there's so much more to talk with you about. The author of The Enemies Within, it's a terrific film as well as an incredibly rich resource in book form. Thank you for joining us, my friend, and for the great work that you do on this and so many other fronts. Come back to us again, if you would, soon.
Pleasure.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back here at the Conservative Political Action Conference, better known as CPAC 2018. In the Gaylord National Harbor establishment, joined by some of the most interesting and, I think, influential people in our country, one of whom, I'm privileged to say, is sitting across the table from me. He is Evan Syed, best known probably for his very successful comedic routines, but deserving both acclaim and appreciation for the serious work he does, thinking about some of the kinds of issues that we're talking about here at CPAC. The Constitution of the United States, for example, and what we best do to preserve it in the face of what seems to be a pretty determined effort to take it apart. Evan Syed, welcome to Washington, the nation's capital, the right coast, as we like to say. Oh, glad thanks. To have you in the flesh.
It's good to be here face-to-face with you for a change.
Yeah.
And how important is CPAC? I got on a plane and traveled 3,000 miles to come to this conference. We've got conferences out west, but this is the one.
Yeah, well, we're glad to have you. It's better for you being here. Tell us a little about the working thesis that you've been developing that gives us some insights into what we're up against, we in the conservative movement, we in the country more general.
At the end of World War II, all right, which is basically what I call the modern liberal era, end of World War II through today, at the end of World War II, it was basically recognized by all decent people that nothing like National Socialism can ever be allowed to happen again.
National Socialism, of course, shortened is Nazism.
Right, yeah, that's the translation would be National Socialism. The left took advantage of this and went about convincing the world the problem with National Socialism was nationalism. It wasn't, of course. The evil of National Socialism is socialism. Nationalism is a morally neutral term. Whether you are patriotic, whether you are a nationalist towards Nazi Germany, then yes, of course it's a force for evil. But had the Brits not been nationalists, they never would have stood up to the evils of socialism. Had Americans not been nationalists, had we not been patriotic, had we not recognized our exceptionalism, we wouldn't have had the mandate or the means or even a reason to stand up against the communists in the Cold War. Mm-hmm. So nationalism is a morally neutral term, but socialism remains the same whether it was national socialism or whether it's what I now call international socialism. Mm-hmm. Socialism without borders, socialism without the patriotism to stand up against the evils of socialism.
Yeah, so define socialism for us. You've got two flavors of it, but what's the common denominator? Is it an economic model or is it something
not
different?
At its very core, it is an economic model, and as such, look, we have tiny bits of socialism in our capitalist society and getting bigger and bigger.
Bigger and bigger, yeah.
But it's far more than that. It's an ideology that includes a lack of individualism. It requires groupthink, and it requires defining people not by their behaviors, but by their skin color, the master race, or as we see it in America now, white people are the inferior race. There's absolutely no difference, right? There's absolutely no difference between thinking a Jew should deserve to be killed in Nazi Germany because he has 1/32nd part Jewish blood, than thinking Elizabeth Warren should get a job because she has 1/32nd part Indian blood, or claims that she does. The idea that blood defines you, the idea that your skin color, that your gender, things that you have no control over and that you're not an individual, you're part of a group, that is the socialism that is terrifying.
Right. The antithesis of the idea of the content of your character. It's all about your ethnic makeup or your bloodline or your political philosophy at the end of the day.
And I know you're going to ask me, because you said it in the introduction, what can we do? I don't know anybody who votes Democrat, Frank. I don't know anybody. I know a ton of people who vote against Republicans. Mostly because they misunderstand what Democrats are today and what Republicans are. So there are two ways to attack this. One is we have to, on a one-on-one basis, make clear that what Democrats think they are not what Democrats are. John Kennedy would be despised by today's Democratic Party. He would be
right.
a fascist.
No, I used to work for Scoop Jackson, who was actually driven out of the party.
But take his most iconic statement. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Today's Democrats believe exactly the opposite. Ask, let your country do everything for you.
Right.
And don't ask what you can do for your country. That's xenophobia. Mm. They don't believe in countries. They don't believe in borders. Mm. So everything that John Kennedy stood for is now diametrically opposed to what the Democratic Party stands for.
Right.
You look at Martin Luther King, which is what led me into this in the run. But Martin Luther King said he wants his children to be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character.
Right.
Today's Democratic Party is all about the color of the skin without regard to character, right. which is why Michael Brown, a career thug, high on drugs, who punches a cop and tries to kill him, is a hero. Because
right.
the content of his character is absolutely, in fact, there's a plaque.
Yeah.
There's a plaque in Ferguson, Missouri, honoring Michael Brown.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. So you got us to the point where one thing that we need to do is to understand the nature of the people who are trying to do this to our country. Once you have that understanding, Evan Sayet, what should we be doing that helps bolster our defenses against what they're doing? And let me just give you one example that's particularly weighing on me. We've been talking about it off and on now for several days. But this whole notion that young people who clearly have not studied the Constitution, who have very little grasp of its importance, let alone how it has defined our country, are quite happy to have it dismembered piece by piece. First Amendment, Second Amendment, and on down the list.
It's difficult in this one way, and then I'm going to give the... Not the solution, but a beginning towards the solution. But in the modern liberal era, post-World War II through today, it's different than any other time in all of human history. All of human history, Frank, think about this. Every other peoples who had ever lived, wherever they had lived, whatever era they had lived in a world with disease, with communicable diseases. Rich people lost children after children. Anybody born after World War II has no idea what a communicable disease is. Smallpox, vanquished. Chickenpox, vanquished. Polio, vanquished. The plague, and that's ancient history. So they don't need to think. They don't live in a world with hunger. They have no idea what hunger is. They live in a world so packed with food that not only do they eat gourmet food, Frank, you can buy gourmet food for your cat. Right? And so they live in a world where nothing can go wrong. And in a world where nothing can go wrong, you don't have to be smart. You can be stupid. And unfortunately, that's what these kids are. They've never lived in a world where being wrong came with consequences.
Yeah. Like losing your life.
Like losing your life. Yeah. Like losing, not only losing your job, but not having unemployment benefits, not having welfare benefits.
Right.
The definition of poverty in America today is ludicrous when you think about what real poverty means. They've never known a world of poverty. They've never known a world of hunger. They've never known a world of disease. They've never known a world with war because America has always been so strong and able to defend ourselves. They don't know the
We've contracted out our wars to small numbers of patriotic Americans who have been willing
absolutely.
To shoulder the burden for
and
the rest of us.
No coincidence, overwhelmingly Republican, overwhelmingly conservative.
Because at least historically.
Because being wrong comes with consequences. You can't be stupid. You can't be wrong.
There are people who we admire greatly for what they have done for our country, as we do you, Evan Sayet, in your work both on the comedic stage as well as in serious places. Thank you, my friend. Come back to us again soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
One of the highlights of the opportunity to broadcast from the Conservative Political Action Conference is I'm finding the chance to catch up with old friends who I don't see nearly often enough. We've been able to speak to some of them with regularity, and that is true of our next guest. He is Richard Pollack, one of the best investigative reporters of our time. These days, hanging his hat and doing his reporting from a really important online resource, the Daily Caller. He heads its investigative project. He is also the veteran of many distinguished media outlets, from Fox News to ABC News. In any event, a man who knows his way around reporting and also this town, this swamp, they call it. Richard Pollack, it's very good to have you. Welcome back. So glad to catch up with you in person.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank.
Well, I thought I might begin because you had an opportunity to actually hear the President of the United States on the other side of doors that I've been looking at while he's been speaking. The remarks have just concluded. Give us your immediate impressions.
This was classic Trump. This was vintage Donald Trump. I think one of the more memorable, the many memorable lines, the one that really stuck to me and actually was one of the many standing ovations that he got from this this crowd, and that was, he said, "We do not worship government, we worship God." And it brought people to their feet. He also talked about the forgotten American, an important theme for his entire campaign, something that pollsters did not detect. They probably haven't polled them for many, many years. And the mass media has just ignored them and, in some cases, too often ridiculed the average American. It was something of a warm-up campaign speech to a certain extent, and sort of a warning, I think, to Democrats that they have to start talking about real issues if they're going to have a chance. You can talk about Russia as much as you want. You can talk about his mental stability. But when you have real money being put into the pockets of Americans, when you have new jobs being created, he talked about the fact that there's the lowest... In this speech, he talked about the fact, and he said this before, it's the lowest unemployment rate for African Americans and for Hispanics. Mm. And it is the lowest unemployment rate for women in 17 years.
Wow.
And then you have people's 401ks who are senior citizens seeing that their stock is going better, their money market and other kinds of equities are doing well. You see companies coming back and creating new jobs. You see all this money being repatriated from Europe and overseas. And they have to do something with the money, so they either have to buy something,
right,
invest in something, or create more jobs.
Yeah. You know, this is so interesting, Richard, because as you say, these are real issues that real people care about. And yet what we're seeing so much of, and you know this town better than just about anybody, is what I call the lemming effect of people being driven primarily, let's be honest, by the Democrats and their friends in the media promoting their memes, by these notions that, they need to have gun control in order to deal with the problem that we just saw in Lakeland, Florida. Or we need to give an amnesty to the DACA kids because we have to deal with that particular problem. And let's go chase after these things where those forgotten Americans, if they actually are touched by either of those issues, and of course everybody's touched on an emotional level by a mass murder, but if they're touched by the solutions that are being proposed, they're likely to find them horrific and respond to the negative. So that brings me to, I guess, the basic question. In terms of the president's remarks, he's obviously speaking to a very favorably disposed crowd. But is it your professional assessment that he's actually resonating with the American people beyond CPAC, the conservatives here?
But let me tell you about something that Rasmussen just released this morning, which is their weekly survey of likely voters. And this last week, Donald Trump hit 50% approval rating.
Wow.
And the
from likely voters, not the whole population or whatever else they poll.
And I'm glad that you mentioned that, because Rasmussen is the only polling company that goes back to likely voters, not to people who are not going to vote or walked away. People who count in elections. And the highest he was prior to this was 45%. And I'm going to tell you something. That number, in my professional opinion, is related to the tax cut and all of its beneficial effects that we're beginning to see in real
rippling
ways.
Through the economy.
Rippling through the economy. I suspect that most Americans, liberals, independents, conservatives, have probably never seen a real impact in their lives because of government. Mm. We hear about
a positive impact.
A positive impact, yes. Yeah. A positive impact.
Plenty of negative impacts.
Negative. Yeah. Right. And I think that that's why a lot of people really are turned off by Washington and the swamp. However, this might be the first time in a lot of people's lifetime that they can see real positive change, that they can feel, touch, and
spend.
Yeah.
But in a way, what's interesting, and of course a very appropriate theme for us here at this Conservative Political Action Conference, is that would be the exception in an instance in which you're getting government off their backs, or necks, as the case may be. Speaking of gun violence and mass murder, Richard Pollack of the Daily Caller, you have done an important and provocative piece recently in your investigative reporting about something that, honestly, in my 40 years in Washington and national policy, I've never, ever seen anything remotely like it, which is you had something like 50 Americans murdered and, you know, vastly larger numbers that were hurt in Las Vegas recently. And it has essentially disappeared. In terms of what happened there, who actually did it, why they did it, and so on. You raised some of questions of your own that need answering. Could you just quickly share with us your thoughts on the investigation and what we need to know at this point?
The Las Vegas shooting, in which 58 people were killed and more than 700 wounded, the largest single mass murder in American history, has disappeared from our headlines. Where are the reporters in America? Where is the sheriff? And what is he doing?
Where is the FBI? Well, we know where the FBI is.
We do know, unfortunately, where the FBI is. But let me just say that I was intrigued about the number of unanswered questions related to this horrific shooting. And I did an investigative piece, as you said, in the Daily Caller.
Very important.
And there was a preliminary report. Now it's preliminary. We understand that can't answer everything. It comes out 4 months after the shooting. You think you're going to get some information. So what's missing? Well, the first thing that's missing is, why did he do it?
Right.
The second thing is, there's no financial profile of him. There's no profile of his friends. There's absolutely no information about why he should have had 18 guns for only one shooter. There are many, many questions lingering out there as to whether, in my opinion, whether or not he was working on behalf of someone, or whether he was a nut.
Or whether he was alone, actually, is one of my abiding questions here.
It
seems as though he may have intended to have company at the very least, as you say, with 18 of these high-powered weapons at his disposal. And he had two rooms.
Why do you need two rooms? The first room was a very, very large suite, a corner suite with wraparound windows, and he could have gotten any angle that he wanted.
Right. And he not only had two rooms, but he had two breaks in the windows from which he had shooting
positions.
He had
two shooting positions.
Seems unlikely, though, all that was for one guy. If I may, just to close this out, you're the best investigative reporter in town. I hope you'll get on this one, because there's a real story here. Richard Pollack of the Daily Caller, thank you so much for finding some time for us today and for the great work you do. Now at the Daily Caller and all that that preceded it, thanks for being with us. As always, come back to us soon.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're in the midst of the Conservative Political Action Conference as we speak, and a man who has played an outsized role in that war for the free world for a long time, because he's understood it better than most, because he has devoted his life to teaching others about it, is, I'm very pleased to say, Dr. Larry Arnn, the president of an extraordinary academic institution in this country, Hillsdale College in Michigan. He is a fixture in almost any good conservative circle, but particularly here at CPAC. And I'm very grateful to him for taking a few minutes before he has to dash off to the airport to visit with us and talk particularly about a project that he's devoted much of his professional life to, and that is our Constitution, respecting it, protecting it, and teaching the next generation to do the same. Dr. Arnn, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so great to have you in person.
I respond to those kind words that I've known Frank Gaffney since Hector was leading the Trojan Army.
And that didn't work out well.
He's a great warrior, and he would die if he had to as bravely as Hector.
Thank you.
It's great to be
Let's hope it doesn't come to that. So, Larry, I've been talking with a number of our guests over the past couple of days here at CPAC about the seeming erosion of the appreciation of our Constitution, let alone a commitment to it on the part of young people. I'm going to stipulate that the young people that populate your college are a breed apart, but they're in the minority. One of the things that I've admired about what you're doing at Hillsdale, though, is trying to make information about your curriculum available to the public beyond your walls. Talk about the two things. Talk about the importance of understanding and protecting the Constitution and what you're trying to do to help encourage that.
So the first heading, if the Constitution actually meant what the people in charge of it say it means, I wouldn't encourage anybody to study it. It's become like a court document. It's what the Constitution really is a string of court cases now. And so to study it is to memorize the doctrines in this long string of thousands of court cases. And who wants to do that? But it's not that. The Constitution of the United States is the only law that the people of the United States ever passed. And it is fewer than 5,000 words long. And it's beautiful, and it's relatively straightforward. And it is the method by which we keep control of our government. They take the exams, and they stop me in the airport, and I ask them how they did, and they look at their feet like freshmen, even when they're 70 years old. So we do that, and we think that's a service we can do. You know, don't you want to know the Shakespeare story? Well, in 10, 40-minute sessions, you can find out about that from somebody who knows a great deal about it. Don't you want to know what the Constitution means? Would you like to, like right now, Frank, there's very exciting things happening in your world. Because we just spent some more money on the military, I'll bet you a lot, not as much as you hope, but more than we were spending, right? That's good. Well, right now, one of the greatest fights for the Constitution is being consistently waged. Because the key, this is just one thing to know, but it's a central thing. We have changed how we make the laws. They're not made, by and large, in the Congress anymore. They're made in the bureaucracy and the courts. And that is what makes it possible for us to make so many more laws and for those laws to be offensive because unaccountable. And so there's an effort, and it's a consistent effort, led by Don McGahn, who's here at this meeting, and I interviewed him on the stage earlier today. He's the White House counsel. But under Trump's direction, and they're trying to do something about that. And so that's exciting. And since it's going on right now, that's another motive to learn what the document means.
Right.
And it's not that hard to do.
Well, let me ask you about one particular case in point. I mean, literally case in point, Larry, that happens to be the nexus between national security in a very important way, I think, and the Constitution and the insinuation of the courts into the process of making the laws, specifically this issue of the transgender decisions handed down by the courts surpassing and trumping, if I could use that expression, the president's directives to the military. This is corrosive in the extreme of the president's Article II powers, I think it's fair to say.
So the constitutional authority for that case, I think, would be the fact that the founders wore wigs. But I don't know.
That's about the extent of it.
I don't know any other. You know, I think the way that thing arose, there was a day when nobody had ever heard of that. And then it arose because there was an order from the Obama administration. Just an executive order. And dear colleague, it wasn't an order, actually. It was a letter to the regulated community, right? Is that a kind of community you want to belong to?
Not so much.
And don't we have a great fellow feeling we regulated? The regulated community got a dear colleague letter saying that schools getting money from the government had to provide for these bathroom arrangements. And that's been upheld in some courts. And when you look for authority of law for that, if you look for it, you can say, if you want to, that the principle of equal protection of the laws and the principle of due process of law means that, but it never meant that before. And those are very old terms, right? They're much older than the United States of America. And so the question then is, not really whether they mean that or not, the question is, do these people who were not elected for such things have the authority to establish such things? Because as Lincoln said once of the Supreme Court of the United States, if the opinion of the Supreme Court in a case that divides them and heard for the first time settles for once and all the meaning of the Constitution, then the people shall have ceased to be their own rulers.
Amen. Larry, we have to close, but I did want to just salute one other great attribute of your scholarship, and that is your serious study of Winston Churchill. And I know you had a hand in this marvelous film, The Darkest Hour, that I'm hoping will be a big winner at the Oscars shortly. An insight from that I thought was so surpassingly important was the principle of that leadership quality emerging when it was desperately needed. And it emanated in part, at least according to the tale, from the people.
Yeah.
The sustenance that Winston Churchill took. Would you just leave us with a closing thought on that subject?
Yeah, well, first of all, Churchill was the teller of that tale.
He was.
He gave examples. Seeing people in bus queues, people stopping him when he was walking across the horse guards parade to work because he hadn't moved into 10 Downing Street yet. And how it would make him cry. He said the island was suffused in a white glow. They had become the lion. And I was merely called upon to give the roar. But here's a lesson for people. Churchill, by the way, thinks just like you, I happen to know, Frank Gaffney, thinks about defense. And that is, it's what you do because you don't want war. So they didn't do that in the 1930s, and they got the war. And then that meant that the man most reluctant to launch a national fight to the death did that because dying is better than being a Nazi.
Amen.
Amen.
Larry, thank you very much for what you do at Hillsdale College. I hope you'll come back for a longer visit with
great
us soon.
To be with you.
Thank you. God bless you and keep up the great work, my friend.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.